Good day, Savannah. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, and this is a commute podcast from SavannahNow.com. On this episode, the Georgia faithful are still numb from winning their first college football title since 1980. One of Savannah's most devoted Bulldog fans, Dr. Mark Murphy, joins the commute today to discuss, and he'll also hit on the COVID-19 pandemic and his thoughts on healthcare legislation needed from the Georgia General Assembly. Today is Tuesday, January the 18th, and this is the Commute Podcast presented by National Office Systems. Mark Murphy takes a break from his physician's rounds to talk with us here in just a moment. In the meantime, let me use a few seconds to tell you about the Commute's presenting sponsor and favorite local business, National Office Systems. Owner Scott Center and his team over at National Office Systems are Savannah's experts in office design and outfitting. They work with top quality suppliers such as Dirt Modular Interior and Herman Miller Office Furniture to create comfortable and productive workspaces. Learn more by visiting www.natoffsys.com. That's www.natoffsys.com. Now, here's the interview with Dr. Mark Murphy. Pleased to be joined on the commute today by Dr. Mark Murphy, who the last time was on called Georgia's shot. And I know, Mark, we were talking about this briefly before we came on. Is it a Babe Ruth moment? Is it a Johnny Carson Swami moment? Is it, I think you said, some other procrastinators? Prognosticators.
Prognosticator. No, the one name I mentioned was Gene Dixon, which to us old people was the lady that predicted that John F. Kennedy would be shot. But, you know, she also made like 30 wrong predictions. And everybody remember the one she made right, not recalling that she predicted all kinds of, like, Martian invasion and all kinds of other stuff. But I make a prediction that people always make fun of me about this. I predict Georgia's going to do great every year, okay? Mm-hmm. And part of that is because, as I said in my article the other day, when I was at Georgia, we only lost four games. The whole four years I was there. So I just expect us to win the national championship at least every other year. And but this year, I felt the strongest that I had about it in a while. We've had a lot of returning talent, and I never would have predicted that Stetson Bennett would lead us to that championship. That was an unexpected plus, but a great story, you know. And he's a nice kid, and it really came through in the clutch. And so it was a call shot, but I have to say it was a call shot that was called on the basis of being called every year and just getting lucky one year.
Yeah, if you say it out loud, it makes it more real, right? That's what you got to do. And for the record, you did call an undefeated season, so you weren't perfect on the money.
Undefeated regular season. I didn't think it was going to happen for sure in the SEC championship. It's funny, David Pollack did better than I did, because Pollack said that we'd go undefeated the regular season, we'd lose to Alabama in the SEC championship game, and beat them in the national championship game. Pollack called that in August. He's better. Of course, that goes without saying. He's David Pollack.
There you go. So, Indianapolis, you made the trip. I know a lot of people that made the trip. It's kind of amazing to me how many people did. Can you kind of set the scene for us? And was it just kind of a great, like somebody lifted something off your shoulders when it finally came true? What set the scene for us?
Okay, well, first of all, I didn't go. I went to Miami. No, I didn't go. I had to have a root canal. Right before I was supposed to leave, I was actually in the dentist chair. Literally, it's 6:30 p.m. on the Thursday that I was leaving to go to Miami for the Orange Bowl. Ended up, just barely making that flight. But I started having some nerve root pain. This is maybe too much detail. But the following week, which is the week before the national championship game, and so, between that and all these flight delays and everything else, and that endodontist wasn't sure if he'd get me in a reasonable time frame. I thought, I can't go to Indianapolis with a bad tooth. So I sold my tickets, and I sold the house that I'd rented for a year. I rented a house for them walking distance to the stadium a year ago. And I sold my tickets and everything, and it all worked out. The guy that got them was really appreciative, and he got the house too, and he thought that was great. And so I watched it on TV, but it was fine, because I also figured something out. So in 1980, I didn't go to the national championship game, and we won. In 1982, I went. In 2017, I went and we lost. So I'm literally like, every time I go, we lose. Every time I don't go, we win. Now I'm 4-for-4 on that. And so the way I look at it, if the odds, if it's coin toss every time, then it's 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5. There's only a 6% chance that's happening by sheer chance. So I really think it's me. I think if I go, we lose. So I'm not going
anymore. So is that that's a commitment to never go? If the everybody says the dynasty is coming, they're going to be there every year now. Are you not going to go?
I'm not that superstitious, really. But I tell you this much. I'm a prediction right now. So I looked at our schedule for next year. I don't see a loss on the schedule in the regular season either. I think they're going to be 12-0 in the regular season, and I think they'll play Alabama for the SEC championship game again next year. So we'll see.
How does the dynasty talk sit with you? I mean, that's a hard mantle to wear.
Bama's done something that nobody's ever done.
Right.
Really? You can't say that. I mean, I'd love to see it happen, but I'm not gonna go on record of saying that I think that's gonna occur. I mean, Kirby recruits well enough to do that, and I think that, you know, realistically, it'd be nice if it happened, but I'm not gonna go in expecting that. I was gonna be disappointed because, I mean, to expect the unprecedented is right. To set yourself up for disaster. I don't expect it.
That's right. Hopefully. My last Georgia question for you references Stetson Bennett, who you brought up earlier. He has another year of eligibility. He's probably not going to play in the NFL or play CFL, play anywhere after college.
Right.
Does he say, I'm going to play one more year because it's my last year of football, or does he ride out and say, I'm going out on top?
He says that he's playing somewhere next year.
Okay.
Whether he stays at Georgia or not is really going to be up to two things, I think, where the coaches want him, which I think it'd be hard to turn the guy down that just won you a national title. And then name, image, and likeness to some extent. I mean, yeah, he's got a real ability to cash in right now with the name, image, and likeness stuff that I think is going to be rare in college quarterbacking circles for somebody who's not going to the pros. He's got that unique position. So personally, I think he sticks around another year. That's what I think. But I have no insider information there. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, well, that would really be something because I think everybody expects Daniels to come back next year stronger than ever. But how do you bench the guy that has taken you to the promised land? So,
well, and you've got Brock Vandegrift on the bench. He's a 5-star and he redshirted this year, and you've got Gunnar Stockton coming in who broke all of Trevor Lawrence's high school records, and he's coming in as a true freshman next year. So the quarterback room is loaded. And as I mentioned, Carson Beck is a 4-star from Florida who was technically the 3rd string this year. So then everybody could come back at QB, which is not going to happen, obviously, but potentially.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Well, that'll be fun to watch. Give you something to talk about between now and September other than hooray, we won. Right.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears and have you put on the physician's hat or the physician's stethoscope, which you have around your neck right now. So that works out just fine.
I'm actually at work today.
Okay. Yep. And so let's talk about COVID-19 pandemic. I know we've talked several times about that over the last 2 years. And of course, we've seen the Omicron variant. It's a very steep climb in terms of spread. It doesn't seem to be as deadly or as sickening as what we've seen in the past. What are you seeing? And do you agree with the whole idea that this thing's going to go up like a rocket and come right back down like a rocket?
Yes. Data suggests, the British data, South Africa, and the European data as well, it looks as though this is a virus that this variant is very, very easily transmissible. So it's easy to communicate, which means you get a rapid spread, peaks quickly, and then comes right back down again because a lot of people get exposed. Now, some of that there's some other variable is that a lot of the demographics in South Africa are a little different. They only are about 25% fully vaccinated, but a lot of people had COVID, okay? And so, you'll get the natural immunity versus vaccination immunity question, which is a question that I'm not going to get into because it's got some political implications from some people. But the bottom line is a little bit slightly different population. The United States right now is about 63% fully vaccinated and about 73% partially vaccinated. So a little bit better than we have been. And certainly better than in that regard than South Africa. That being said, we're also a larger country, more heterogeneous, lots of different variables at work here, different climates in different parts of the country. I do think that the general trend is going to be straight up and straight back down again, which means I think we'll be transitioning into a more endemic phase of this pandemic probably by spring. Is it worse in terms of communicability? Yes, unequivocally. Is it more severe? Probably not. It looks like it does not get into the alveoli, the lung air sacs as much. It's more bronchial, and we'll get into the bronchial tubes. But here's the thing. It can still be deadly. This is what people don't realize. It's not like if you're a person at high risk, you have underlying lung disease, or if you're diabetic, hypertensive, all these risk factors we've identified previously, you should just go out and try to get infected. Or say, well, to hell with it, I'm going to do whatever I want. I mean, the bottom line is, especially if you have this high risk factors, if you're older, if you're unvaccinated, it can still be lethal. And we've seen people die from Omicron in Savannah. We've got 5%, I mean, almost 100% of what we're seeing in Savannah right now is Omicron. And we've got, 10 people on ventilators with Omicron right now in the city. Granted, that's not the, the 40 or 50 we had with Delta, but right. It's still not zero. And if one of those people is you, that's a bad outcome.
That's right. That's right. So I think the question that has been kicked around for a while now, and I think we almost have to say this is reality now, is this is going to be with us probably for a very, very long time. How do we go about living with it? How do we treat it? How does it become like the seasonal influenza?
Well, I mean, that's what we're going to be dealing with. When I mentioned a minute ago that I said it's going to transition into endemicity, that's medical speak for it's going to transition from a pandemic phase, which we're, I think, seeing the last gasp of right now. No, terrible pun. make it. But we're seeing the very last bit of this pandemic phase where it's everywhere to an endemic phase, meaning that it's going to be one of these viruses that we see as a seasonal respiratory virus, probably ad infinitum, probably as long as any of us are alive. And there'll be a different vaccine for whatever variant comes out that year. But it's not going to be this huge, resource stressing pandemic that we've seen in the past 2 years going forward, I don't think. And the reason I think that is you can't get much more transmissible than Omicron. I mean, Omicron took over because it's so easily transmitted. It's like chickenpox or measles. It's one of those highly communicable viruses for which many of us don't have much immunity, okay? Although we're developing more and more immunity. But I think once that goes through, it's almost like what we call a live attenuated vaccine. This is that it's going to infect a lot of people. And between that and actual vaccination, you're going to see a lot of people who have immunity to the last few strains that we've seen. And it's unlikely we're going to have a strain that comes along that is even more communicable than Omicron. It's just there are not many viruses out there that are that contagious. So I think that's why that we're going to be seeing this transition into an endemic phase, where basically we just see periodic local flare-ups over the next however many decades we're alive.
Yeah, and in the meantime, we're developing the equivalent of Tamiflu, right? We've got a couple of anti-COVID pills now, and those will continue to get better and better and better.
Exactly. The new pills are the Pfizer one in particular is really effective. About 70%. That's actually much better than Tampa, which is, will attenuate the severity and shorten the duration of the influenza. But it doesn't do as good a job of really keeping disease at bay as the new Pfizer pill does. So they're short supply right now. I mean, they're not out there really. They're hard to find. But they'll ramp their manufacturing up, and we'll have those things going forward in the future for sure. Probably over the counter at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that? So let's spend the balance of the time talking a little bit about the Georgia General Assembly. They started up a week ago, and healthcare legislation is – there hasn't been a lot of talk about healthcare legislation this right. end of this term. I mean, they passed the healthcare waiver, the Medicaid waivers a couple of sessions ago. Those have got hung up. Now it's an election year, so they don't want to really discuss Medicaid expansion. They really don't want to the Republicans don't want to discuss Medicaid expansion. The Democrats don't want to say, okay, well, we'll budge on the waivers if you do this. It's just completely divided. We're probably not going to see a whole lot of movement on that in this session. But as you look at it, and let's start there with the Medicaid expansion versus the waivers. I know the waivers to me always seem like a Band-Aid when you needed some stitches. To use a medical term, it just didn't cover enough of the uninsured people. In your column that you wrote that ran in the Sunday Extra print over the weekend, you talked about, hey, Medicaid expansion is we probably need to really start taking that seriously. The federal government's putting a lot of money into it. Well, we as Georgia need to help the people that really are uninsured and need the help. Can you kind of talk us through that? And as a physician, what are some of your concerns with the whole idea of Medicaid expansion, because a lot of people talk about the quality of care.
So here's the thing. The bottom line is our highest at-risk population, and Georgia doesn't do a great job with healthcare. I mean, I'm a physician in the state. I love it. I'm a native of Georgia. But, you know, you saw the surveys I put in there. We're 49th or 50th in the country in terms of overall quality of care. That's terrible. Okay, that's just inexcusable. And a big chunk of that is the fact that we've got still a 13.4% uninsured population in this state. You know, even after the Affordable Care Act was supposed to expand that, and a chunk of that, about 5% of that shortfall, is the refusal to expand Medicaid. And the ostensible reason for doing that originally was because originally the federal government was going to fund it for a couple of years, and the states were going to take over
and drop it. Yeah,
you know, they didn't want to saddle the state with that. Well, you know, I mean, we've got $3.2 billion budget surplus this year. I mean, clearly the state's not hurting for money right now, despite the pandemic. This would be an ideal time to try to expand that. Because here's the thing. In healthcare, the payoff for investing in the health of your constituents as a state representative, state senator, or congressman, or whatever, is that you don't pay the downstream cost. You engage in things like preventative medicine, like hypertension control and you know, diabetic control, and you avoid strokes and renal failure and heart attacks and things that tax the system a lot more on down the road. So your return on investment is huge. But you can't do that if they don't have insurance, because they won't seek medical care. So you end up in the ICU or the ER. And you can't do that. You can't engage in primary prevention if you don't have enough primary care doctors, and we don't. So to me, it's very short-sighted and unfortunately very politically motivated, not looking at the big picture, refusing to recognize the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is, what do we do to make us all better collectively and to decrease our tax liability going forward in the long run? Is, you know, you've got to put the politics on the back burner and say, what's good for Georgia? What is good for our state? What's good for our state is having more people covered and then more primary care doctors. I mean, that's where our big shortfalls occur. That's why primary care in the state of Georgia, it's fine if you got insurance and it's fine if you got a PCP, but you've got, you know, 13% of the population that is not going to seek medical care until it becomes an emergency. And that's awful. I mean, that's just not, there's just, I can't tell you how many people I see every day. I saw a patient yesterday, my age, in the ICU, uncontrolled diabetic hypertensive after a four-vessel bypass, who's in septic shock because they've got an aspiration pneumonia that happened after their surgery. She shouldn't even be in surgery. She shouldn't be having a heart bypass. All this is happening because she didn't take care of herself for years, and now we're reaping the aftermath of that. And that's the point I was making in the article the other day, is we need to be focusing on preventing end-stage pathology that puts people in the ICU, because that's where the real expense is. It's not in diabetic control. That's relatively inexpensive. It's not in vaccination. It's in strokes and heart attacks and cancer and those things that cost a heck of a lot of money that we deal with maybe 10 years down the road. But because of politics, the Republicans and the Democrats both are not willing to work with each other, because they don't want to weaken their party's position. And, you know, I'm not going to use the word that I'd like to use for that, but it has to do with excrement. But anyway, the bottom line is it makes my job that much harder, you know, and it makes all of our jobs in healthcare that much harder to be dealing with the downstream effects of this stuff after it should have been addressed a decade earlier at the preventative stage. And that's what the whole article is focused on. Let's do something positive for Georgia that helps them shore up our primary care base and give more constituents insurance so they can avoid those complications on down the road that cost everybody money.
Right. And I think the argument on the other side of that is that will they seek that for, just because they have the insurance, will they seek the preventative care? Is there something in your mind that can be done that says if you're taking Medicaid, you've got to get a physical every year? I mean, are there some things in there that could be done to help that?
Absolutely. I mean, that kind of thing, incentivizing people to control their blood pressure or their tobacco use, you know, smoking cessation, things that, with lower premiums, for example, or lower copays. I mean, there are things you can do that will hit people in the pocketbook that will motivate them to do these things. But they're not going to do it if it costs them money out of pocket when they got no money to begin with.
Right.
They're not going to get a doctor to control their blood pressure when they don't even feel their blood pressure is high, or they don't they don't know their blood sugar is elevated because they're not checking it.
Right.
Until they show up with a hemoglobin A1C of 11 and a stroke, they'll go, well, you know, I haven't really checked my blood sugar in a couple of years. And that happens. Yeah. But they're not spending money on a glucometer or on blood pressure medicine if they don't have any insurance. They'll spend money on cigarettes. That's another story. But the bottom line is that people, they're naturally in tune towards what impacts them that day, politicians and the rest of us, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they're going to do what looks good right now or what feels good right now without thinking about the long-term consequences. But there absolutely are ways you can motivate people to do the right thing for themselves. And just like they try to motivate doctors to do the right things for patients. We're incentivized to control blood pressure, to get vaccinations, to do screenings. That's all positive. But if the doctor's not seeing you, those things aren't going to be done anyway.
Yeah, I think we've hit on something. Instead of a work requirement for Medicaid, there needs to be a physical, get a physical every so often and get all your stuff checked every so often in order to keep it. But.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a great thing. And right. You know, the work requirement thing is, I mean, that's, I think for having a work requirement for Medicaid, the underlying upshot of that is not unadmirable. I think it's more applicable to, for example, if you're getting paid disability or something like that, it's more, there's more direct correlation. But I think what you're hitting on here is that if you're doing with healthcare benefits, look at healthcare outcomes, look mm-hmm. at healthcare motivation, look at things that motivate people to take better care of themselves. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's how you tie it more directly to this legislation. To me,
right?
I'm not a politician, but that's the way I would do it.
Another thing you talked a lot about was, and you mentioned this, is the shortage of primary care, of especially in rural areas, of specialists. Georgia's got a couple of medical schools, Emory Medical College of Georgia. It's not like we don't have places to train these doctors and these physicians. And I know this is something that the state has wrestled with going back to the Deal administration. What's it going to take to really move the needle to get more people in medical school and then the people that are coming out of medical school in Georgia to get them to stay here?
See, that's the thing. The medical school population is part of it, but most physicians practice where they do their residency and fellowship, okay? Right. So we don't have enough residency and fellowship slots to keep them in state. I mean, I'm from Georgia. I went to med school here. I went to undergraduate school here. Obviously, I got my red and black outfit on. But the bottom line is I trained in North Carolina.
Okay.
I did my residency and fellowship in Chapel Hill. And I had plenty of offers in North Carolina and Virginia. I came back home because my dad said, hey, we'd like to have you come back. And there's a job opportunity for you here that's how I knew about it. My dad's a physician. So he let me know about something, but had I not had that connection, I might've taken one of the many offers I got in North Carolina and Virginia to practice medicine up there. We need more residency slots here. We need, and the problem is the number of AC, the American College of Graduate Medical Education, the ACGME, has, through Medicare, has funded most of the residency slots in this country since 1997. They haven't increased in 24 years.
Oh, wow.
This past year, they increased them by 200 a year over 5 years, spread over the whole country. That's not a lot, okay? But we could fund some of those residency slots from the state legislature. The individual hospitals could be given money to fund them, or they can decide to fund them on their own. But, you know, we've got teaching programs in Savannah, both in Camp St. Joe and at Memorial. We've got teaching programs at, in Athens and Augusta and Macon and Columbus. But we need to expand those, and we need to have more teaching programs in the state of Georgia because residents will work with physicians here, and they'll get to know them. And, I mean, half of the practicing physicians in Savannah trained at Memorial.
Right.
I mean, they came here. They like Savannah. Say, hey, I'd like to stick around. You know, we've got two former Memorial residents who are in my GI practice as partners. Okay. That's where you get people to stick around. And the flaw in the reasoning here is, I mean, granted, it's great to have medical schools here, but a lot of the medical students don't necessarily stay here. They may go to Texas.
Right.
California, their residency, and they may decide they like it out there and stay there. You want them here when they're looking for jobs.
Yeah. And in the interest of fairness, I mentioned Medical College of Georgia and Emory. I think I left out Morehouse, Mercer.
Right.
Are those the other, is that the four medical schools in the state?
Well, there's the Morehouse and Mercer, MCG and Emory, the four big ones.
Right.
There's an osteopathic medical school in Atlanta as well that also puts people in residency programs.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. there are just as many doctors being trained in residency now as there were 20-something years ago. There are 110 million more Americans now.
Oh, okay.
And so there are probably two qualified medical school applicants for every one that actually gets into med school. So that's why a lot of these residency programs will take foreign medical grads, you know, because if they pass the exam that gets them into a residency program, they can practice here, and a lot of them do. But that's to me, the bottleneck is not as much with the med schools as in the residency. We need more residency slots. Right. And they cost money. They're not cheap. I mean, you don't get paid much. I mean, I got paid $18,000 my intern year. I went just a long time ago, but still, they don't get paid a lot. But it does cost, you know, $50,000 a year for salary and benefits, and probably $100,000 a year per resident to fund those slots altogether.
Yeah, well, that sounds like something the legislature could maybe try to tap into and do some things with. So, well, Mark, we've hit a lot of topics. I appreciate your time as always, and hopefully, there's not anybody waiting on you to run back to. But congratulations again on Georgia's win. It's going to be a long off season, and I think the Buckeyes are going to give you a run next year. We're going to cross our fingers. They play some defense next year.
You got a whole new defensive staff, I saw.
Sure. They got a new defensive staff. We'll see if that translates to that. Those guys can't strap on the helmet and play, but we'll cross our fingers anyway. But thanks again, Mark.
All right, thanks. Appreciate it.
Other news of note in Savannah today. The Martin Luther King Jr. Monument was unveiled Saturday at Plant Riverside, with speeches from local dignitaries and music from a pair of superbly talented choirs. The memorial is Savannah's first recognizing a black individual and is located at the terminus of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard overlooking the Savannah River. Elsewhere, Georgia House Rep. Derek Mallow is eyeing higher office. The first-term representative has announced a run for the Georgia Senate and the seat long held by Senator Lester Jackson, who is vying for Georgia Labor Commissioner and won't seek another Senate term. Mallow is the first to announce for the soon-to-be-open seat. Election qualifying starts March the 7th, and the primary is May the 25th. And in sports, the Florida Gators club ice hockey team captured the 23rd Thrasher Cup over the weekend in the M Market Savannah Hockey Classic. Florida was the lone team in the four-team field to win both its games in the tournament. It marks only the sixth time the Rumble in the Rink was not won by either Georgia or Georgia Tech. By the way, Georgia beat the in-state rivals 4-3 in Saturday's finale. Read those stories and more at SavannahNow.com, the online home of the Savannah Morning News. Get full access to SavannahNow.com and our mobile app for just $49 for the next year. Go to SavannahNow.com/subscribe now and sign up. Again, that's SavannahNow.com/subscribe now. That's all for the Tuesday Commute Podcast. Thanks again to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. For more interviews with local newsmakers, check out the Commute Archives by searching The Commute with That Savannah Opinion. The Commute returns Thursday and will feature the annual Year in Review, Year in Preview discussion with Savannah Mayor Van Johnson. Thank you for listening.